everybody, and welcome to another True Stories of Tinseltown. And I am really excited to have this guest today because I really love, I mean, it's not my favorite genre, but it's a genre that I appreciate, and especially classic movie sci-fis. So I have a woman here who has written a wonderful book called Must-See Sci-Fi. TCM puts it out. Right? Do they publish it, correct?
TCM publishes it with Running Press as the book publisher, yes.
Yes. So I absolutely loved it. And you guys will love it. It's 50 films. It starts from the first sci-fi until, where do we go, into the 90s?
Oh, all the way up to 2016, honey.
Oh, gee, I didn't get that far because I knew what I was going to talk about. So I have a lot more to read, but you guys are going to love this. And for you non-sci-fi fans, some of these movies are just amazing and they are must-see. They're not your typical, they're really good is what I can say. And I love the book. I enjoyed reading what you wrote, you know, because not only did you write the synopsis and what it's about, you wrote a lot of other different asides, which I found fun. And, you know, you gave tidbits and like wowie kazowie kind of stuff.
Right.
I loved it. So tell me, Sloan, how did you get started writing sci-fi? Were you always into the films or is this something you just like, well, let me discover this and I'm going to write this book?
Yeah, a little of both. I kind of had an affinity for some sci-fi films that I came across as a youngster. You know, I think it can be traced back to when I was 11 years old and I spent the summer with my grandparents out in the country in Texas, and they didn't have anything to do. They didn't have MTV or they didn't have video games. They just had basic television, and they showed The Blob. And The Fly, I think, that summer. So I got a double shot, yeah. And I really, really enjoyed them both. They made a big impact on me. As you can imagine, at 11, I think you're just at the right age for the Blob and The Fly. So I did enjoy those classic sci-fi movies. I later discovered Forbidden Planet and some others as well. But I wouldn't call myself a hardcore, you know, sci-fi aficionado. Until I got into classic film more, and I got into writing about classic film, and then I ended up contributing to some other books, and long story short, Turner Classic Movies and Running Press asked me if I would. I pitched a book to them. It was more about women in film noir, actually. This was back in 2017, and they said, well, we just published a book on film noir, so that's out, but, you know, would you be interested in writing a book on, you know, the greatest sci-fi movies? And I said, absolutely. That was my next choice, so it worked out perfectly.
And it's so good. And like you, you know, I am not like some sci-fi aficionado. I have to admit, some you guys may go, oh no, I have never seen Star Wars. I have never seen.
Wow.
Yeah, not one. I never saw Star Wars. I did see E.T. I did see Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I did see some of them, but a Star Wars film I have never seen.
That's incredible. You know, it would really be fun, I think, for you to watch Star Wars and The Empire Strikes Back someday, if you can catch them on the big screen especially. But I wouldn't recommend the others necessarily. People may be hating on me for saying that.
Oh, the other ones?
It's true.
The ones, oh, the later Star Wars, you mean.
The later ones, yes. I would see the first one, and the second one, The Empire Strikes Back from 1980, is really my favorite. That's a good one.
I gotta check that out. Okay, so you decided to write this book. How did you choose which ones you were going to write about?
That was a difficult process. You know, I made a list, a tentative list, and sort of sent it back to TCM, and everyone at TCM who gets to weigh in, whoever this is, all those people are, I don't know them all. The fine folks at TCM weigh in and they say, no, let's take this off and let's add this. And it was a lot of back and forth. Mm-hmm. So I think we whittled it down to one that everyone was happy with. But it's very difficult, you know, with sci-fi, because you feel like, oh my God, the fans are going to go crazy if I leave this movie out and this movie. And so in the end, you know, there's only room for 50. So you just kind of have to go with your gut.
And you chose great ones. But I also like how you kind of put companion films, like two companion films after. Mm-hmm. I guess they were runners up, right? If you watch this film, this is similar. You should watch something like this.
It was a way to squeeze in some of the others that didn't make the cut. Exactly. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, because I love some of the ones that you squeezed in. Okay. Mm-hmm. So we got the scoop on that now, and you were not, because like I said, I love sci-fi, but classic movies I love, and sci-fi isn't my favorite genre, but I really like it. And you know what's funny, Sloan, is that when I did my second annual Spooktacular for the podcast, and it was
That sounds fun.
Yes, and I was looking for 50 sci-fi spooktaculars, but I couldn't, whatever. I ended up going with like a ghost spooktacular, and so then I found you. And I have to be honest, when I saw Sloan, I didn't see her. I thought it was a guy.
Yeah.
Sloan. And then it's a woman. I was like, whoa, I love this. I love that this woman is writing this book and has written this book. And, you know,
it's very unusual for a woman to write a book about sci-fi movies.
You ain't kidding. I couldn't find any.
Yeah, I might be one of the only ones. I might be the only one. So that was a place of distinction, an honor for me, certainly.
It is. And you did such a good job. And
thank you.
I was thrilled because it's like, here I am. And when I talk about sci-fis on my page, because I think the people who come to my page aren't really sci-fi aficionados. They like the other stuff, like mm-hmm. the bogeys, the pre-co, whatever. But
right.
They're going to like this because these movies are just so great. How could you not?
Well, I mean, when you what I found is I meet a lot of people who say, oh, I'm not really into sci-fi. And then you say, well, do you like the movie, Frankenstein? And they'll be like, well, yeah. Or do you like the movie, especially some of the 80s ones. Do you like Back to the Future? Well, I love Back to the Future. Okay, well, that's science fiction. I think a lot of people don't really give science fiction the broad definition that it actually is. It's not just the hardcore kind of set in outer space on spaceships movies necessarily. It goes a bit beyond that.
Definitely. And I love how Roger Foreman wrote your foreword. I adore him. He has done so many. He's directed so many great films, so many, like The Pit and the Pendulum. I can't even, The Wasp Woman. Who doesn't love The Wasp Woman?
Right. And I love The Little Shop of Horrors.
Me too.
The originals, one of my favorites.
Done so many wonderful films. So it was really nice to read him as a foreword. You said something when you watched all 50 films, you found one commonality about them all, which I thought was really great.
That one scene, they can't be forgotten.
Yes. And that one scene, they can't be forgotten. It's not.
They make a big impact, right? They all make a big impact on the mind. They sort of wedge themselves somewhere in the back of your mind, and you can't forget them.
No, and even a lot of these movies I haven't seen in a long time, but I have never forgotten them. So why don't we start?
Right.
I want to start with this first. I guess it was a first sci-fi movie, but it was like a short called A Trip to the Moon.
It was actually not, it is considered a short today. At its time, it was considered an epic because, movies were only one reel. Mm. They were about, 7 to 10 minutes max in that era. They didn't do multiple reels. So this was a double reel. This was a two reeler, 15 minutes, 10,000 francs. This was the equivalent of a big budget Hollywood epic. This was the equivalent of Avatar in its day. 117 years ago, if you can believe.
I know, I can't. So it's interesting. I love. She also has photos from each film, and I love the Marines, the woman Marines, mm-hmm. and their uniforms. I mean, they are just...
They're pretty styling for Marines, aren't they? They look a little bit more like chorus girls.
Yes, they do.
I still appreciate the nod to, it's a little bit predictive of our current female Marines, isn't it, that we do have in this
and
day
and age.
And
I love it, especially since the time it was. And the director, there was no... He invented a moving camera, right? The director?
He didn't invent the moving camera, but he devised his own. I mean, the movie cameras had already been invented. This is Georges Méliès we're talking about. Mm-hmm. But they weren't commercially available yet in France when he first started. So he did sort of devise his own, I think, in a way. He was very much a tinkerer and an inventor, and he very much devised the special effects industry kind of as it became established in the movies, as far as making things disappear and, you know, using trick shots and all of that.
I have to see that. I wonder if I can get that on YouTube, maybe.
Yes, you can.
Oh, good.
In fact, you can see it on YouTube. They did in 2011, they restored the color, the hand-painted color version that they had found and restored, and they gave it a new score by the band Air. It's like a futuristic score. It's really cool. I recommend watching that one.
I will definitely do it. And it's only 15 minutes, but it's an epic, you guys. The second one, which I think is like amazing, 1927's Metropolis, directed by Fritz Lang. That is like, wow.
It is like, wow, indeed. You know, Metropolis is, I don't know, I kind of liken it, maybe it's just me, but I always think of, you know, I don't know if you know the Velvet Underground, the band. Uh-huh. There's a saying about the Velvet Underground that not that many people bought their record when it came out, their first album, but everyone who bought it started a band. That's how influential they were. That's how I think of Metropolis. It wasn't a big box office hit, and yet everyone who saw it, look at the impact. I mean, it has on our culture, on filmmaking. You know, you can see it in Things to Come. You can see it in Forbidden Planet. You can see it in Blade Runner. I mean, so many.
And it was really ahead of its time, but it also showed the worker bees, the upper class, the whole thing in sci-fi, mm-hmm. and the future and the machinery and all this stuff, which wasn't out. It just wasn't there. And I found it visually stunning and also visually busy, whereas, you know, it's a movie that I can't watch all the time. It's like something I'd have to watch every few years because it
has
so
much. It's kind of exhausting, isn't it?
It is. It's like, oh my goodness, phew. Mm-hmm. But I enjoyed it. But again, like, I'm like, I'm getting a headache or something like that. It's too much. But it's a really good movie to watch. And I like it. And to think it's 1927. So I want to go into the next film. And a lot of people, I loved that you put this as sci-fi, because a lot of people do not see it as sci-fi. They see it as horror. And I'm talking about Frankenstein. It is both. Yeah, Frankenstein.
Yes. Well, it's both. I mean, it's, you know, the two are not mutually exclusive.
Exactly.
There's a lot of crossover in horror and science fiction, but it's definitely science fiction. In fact, it may be one of the first science fiction stories ever written. I mean, 1818
Mary
is
Shelley,
when it was written.
A woman.
Mm-hmm. I know, a woman.
I think that's so great. But it was.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a guy, Colin Clive, who is perfection as the Dr. Frankenstein.
And so, yes.
Yeah, he had such a tragic life. You know, he was an alcoholic. He was so damn skinny. I'm like, please eat, Colin.
I know.
He was so thin. He did tons of different movies, but he was in this one. And they were having trouble. Who did they? They wanted to cast somebody different as the monster.
Well, it was originally supposed to go to Bela Lugosi as a follow-up to Dracula. They even shot a screen test. It just didn't work out for various reasons. And then they spotted, I guess, according to the legend, James Whale, the director, spotted Boris Karloff in the Universal Commissary having lunch. He had been just a bit player. And, you know, he was very tall and gangly. And, you know, they tested him and saw that he was just perfect. So it was one of those fortuitous discoveries that we've all...
That's
just become so iconic, you know. How can you imagine Frankenstein without Boris Karloff, you know?
He's so fabulous. And the funny part is he was 40-ish, right?
Yeah. Yes, he had been around Hollywood for years. He had done silent movies. He started in theater. So what an amazing turn of luck for him.
He had a great career. I was just watching last night. He did this series called Thriller. And I love that. And he played, they did a thriller on the one when the guy's buried alive. And what's that called?
The Telltale Heart? No. Premature Burial. Right. Yes.
And he was in that. That's such a good one. And he was just great. And the scene, you know, he's just this, I feel sorry for him because he's just this person thing. That nobody, you know, he didn't want to come back. He was forced to come back as this, like, creature. And,
yeah,
you know, they get the wrong brain for the poor dude. But he's trying. And then he's just trying to frolic with the little girl, you know. And he,
he sort of misunderstands how playing works and how water works and how gravity works. It's not deliberate is what's so sad. Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, the angry crowds, the torch with the torches, go get him. But what I love is that his daughter talked about that scene. And also my last spooktacular, Gregory William Mank, who has written amazing classic Hollywood horror things, women in horror, all sorts of stuff, Bella and all the gang. And he said, as his daughter did, that he was so, Boris was very distraught about having to do that scene. He did not want to have to do that scene with that little girl. And so he drove the little girl and her mother to go to the set. And he explained to her, you know, that you're a good kid and I don't want to do this. And it's, you know, just something that we're going to do, but I like you. And to show her that he's a nice guy and that he's not some big monster. And to his horror, not only did they have to do it once, he had to do another take. So that really, really stayed with him. And that it really bothered him that he had to do that scene.
Yeah, I can see that. Because he was kind of a gentle giant. I've heard he was a pretty nice guy.
Oh, yeah. Smart.
Yeah.
I just, you know, I'm really crazy about Boris. And who can forget him in The Grinch? Come on. Who could do that?
I know. That's what, that was my first introduction to Boris Karloff. I'm sure it was a lot of people. Yeah.
Mine too. I just adore him. The Grinch. Anyway, but Frankenstein was a great movie. And it was, but do you know what I mean? In a lot of places, it does not say it's science fiction. It puts it just in the horror genre. And that's why I really liked that you put that there. Okay, so we're going to get to the next film, because there are a lot that I haven't seen that I'm going to see. This one is El Creepy Aruni, one of the creepiest to this day, Island of Lost Souls.
Yes, it's very disturbing, isn't it?
Oof. Yes.
Well, horrible to the point of repugnance. Yeah, that was the Los Angeles Times description.
Is that what it said? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, and that's, I think it's pretty accurate. I mean, it was banned in so many places, many countries banned it entirely. Other places just cut, you know, certain scenes out, but it was shocking. And it still is, I think. It's just, you know, it's about, I mean, a man doing living operations on these horrible animals. They're painful. And not only that, but then the implications of bestiality. He wants one of his creatures to mate with a human.
Yes.
Yikes.
What is she? The leopard woman or the...
She's the Panther Woman,
and she falls in love with the Richard Arlen, who is a guy who's a castaway there, and Dr. Thoreau, played by Charles Laughton, is a fiend. And it has been remade 2 times, but nothing can compare to this one. And I only saw this one a couple years ago. My friend said, watch it. He sent me the DVD. I watched it, but I was like, you know what, you know, like painting my toenails, doing this, not watching the whole thing. And then mm-hmm. I'm like, big deal. Then I watched it again, and I was like horrified. And then,
yeah, if you really pay attention, you see what's going on. It is horrifying.
And Bella is great as the keeper of the laws. Mm-hmm. And this guy, this just is like this monster. And he does vivisection, trying to turn animals into human beings. And, you know, he just, you can hear their screams. It's called the House of Pain. And it's just awful. And so the guy's chick gets there. And since the Panther Woman and the other guy didn't mate, he wants this monster to come into his girlfriend's place and mate with her. Such charm, such elegance.
I know, right? It's just absolutely horrific. It's like you said about Metropolis. I can't watch this film very often. You know, it gives me the willies.
Me too. And but it's something to be seen. And as yes. you wrote, and this is something I wrote a couple weeks ago when we were talking about this film, versus like Frankenstein or Dracula. And it's like they are Shirley Temple films compared to this.
Right. And yet it's so beautifully shot. You know, the cinematography is exquisite. So I definitely recommend anybody watch it. But, you know, I don't know how often you can really bring yourself to watch it.
Right.
But once, certainly.
And it really, you would not be... It shouldn't be missed, and especially if you've seen either of the other two, because this one is the ultimate. And the screaming, you know, we're not spoiling anything, but boy, some of that screaming is pretty horrific.
You know, torture. It's very disturbing. It's very disturbing. And I think the reason it didn't really become a cult classic like Dracula and Frankenstein is because it was banned for so long. You know, it couldn't be shown for years.
Sort of like Freaks, something you didn't write about. But, you know, that was banned for how many years? Years and years and years and years.
Yeah, similar to Freaks, you're right. It was that era when the pre-code, when they weren't, you know, people think of pre-code movies as just being sexy, but no, they had pre-code horror that was grotesque as well.
You got it. Okay, so we're moving now. I want to go, because there's so many great ones in the 50s, and the first one I want to go to is from 1951, and this is one of my all-time faves, The Thing from Another World.
Me too. You're talking my language. That's one of my favorite movies.
I agreed with what you said because it had all elements and they all worked together. There was humor, horror, romance, a scientist. I am your friend. Whack. And James Arness in that fabulous, outfit.
Mm-hmm.
How tall was James? Like 6'5"?
I don't know. He's pretty tall. Yeah, I would say 6'4", six, maybe 6'5", something like that.
And this was his debut film.
Yes, and he was none too thrilled. You know, sort of like Karloff, none of these men want to play grotesque monsters. You can't really blame them. But in the case of James Arness, at least he didn't have a lot of screen time. You just sort of saw the suggestion of him more, you know, than spending a lot of time on him, which I think was a wise choice on the filmmaker's part, you know, because you really don't want to see too much of his costume. It kind of, you know, it may look a little flimsy as opposed to what you can imagine, you know. The suggestion of it is much scarier.
I liked what you wrote about when he was saying the guy went out there. I don't know. He was one of the big cheat. He was a guy from the station in the North Pole, not one of the Army guys or Navy guys, Army guys who came over. But he saw that two of the men had been hung upside down. We didn't need to see all that yuck. It's in our imagination, you get it. It's like, just hearing it gives you the creeps. So they did that kind of an innuendo, but it was such a wonderful film. I loved the characters. I thought, you know, there was no one that was a big star in the film, but it worked. They were all great. And it is, I think it is definitely one of my favorites. I own the movie and I watch it in the summer when it gets really hot in New York so that I can pretend I'm cold.
Oh, I get it. Yeah, that's smart. Hadn't thought about that.
I love
that. Cool you right off.
And they have the bright woman who's in love with Scotty, and she's not just the arm candy. And she actually comes up with a thing on how to kill the Beast.
Right. She's, as I say in the book, she's a Hawksian woman. You know, Howard Hawks was known for these women like Lauren Bacall and or like Barbara Stanwyck in Ball of Fire, you know, who are very feisty.
These and great to me, days. She's, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. She's kind of like that. So I love that aspect of it as well. Of course, a lot of the hardcore sci-fi and horror male fans, I find, will deride that. Oh, it has this silly, ridiculous subplot about some kind of romance in it. But aside from that, it's a good movie. No, I think I like the romance. I like the humor. Like
I
you,
do too.
It adds so much to it. Otherwise, it would just be, you know, a monster and them trying to kill it. And you know, there's many different layers to the movie that make it entertaining.
Very entertaining, and I love it. Okay, so the next one I want to go to is 1951, The Day the Earth Stood Still, which is a wonderful film. Wonderful.
Yes. Agreed. Another one of my favorites.
Mine too.
I mean, 51, what a great year. You had The Thing from Another World and The Day the Earth Stood Still, two very different, you know, films, but such seminal works, you know.
I thought it was great when they were looking for someone to play Klaatu, they chose James Rennie, who was pretty much, he was unknown in the United States.
Or Michael Rennie.
Oh, Mike, I'm sorry, Michael Rennie. Right. I get that way sometimes. Michael Rennie, who was fabulous, and he did such a great job. And that guy who played the robot, he was 7 feet tall in real life. Wow.
Ouch. Yeah, I believe he had some health problems. You know, he probably had a disorder
right.
that made him so tall, but that was, you know, it worked.
Yes, Gork. He was Gork. And
right.
So,
well, Michael Rennie, you know, it's funny. I mean, to me, this is his role, and he later did some great stuff as well. But, you know, I can't see Michael Rennie without thinking of him as Klaatu. He's an alien to me. Don't you find that?
Me too. He's so fabulous, Klaatu. But also, you know, he kind of mixed in with the general population as this kind guy who boards at Aunt B's house from Andy Griffith. And they're all talking about him, and he befriends Patricia Neal, who's a widow, and her son. And Patricia Neal has a creepy, I guess they're engaged. He's the guy who played, he was in All About Eve, and I heard he's a real lech in real, he was IRL in real life. But he played a creepiness.
Oh, Hugh Marlowe,
yes,
right.
Hugh Marlowe.
Yes, he's pretty nasty. He's a nasty piece of work in this, her fiance. Yeah.
I hope she dumped him after. Anyway,
she dumped him during the movie, I think, actually, you know, which is a good decision. I like her relationship. It wasn't a romance, but I like her relationship with Klaatu as well. You know, they had a really kind of cool interplanetary thing going on.
Yes, very, very, you know, it was not a sexual thing. It was a friendship. She trusted him. He trusted her. And she had to take a huge leap of faith to trust him. And then the world literally stands still at that time.
Yes.
They're stuck in an elevator, and all over the world, things happen. He comes as a good thing to warn the world of the troubles of what's going on. And this is also a part of the atomic age where the 50s really, really rolled those out. You know, about things that can happen with atomic bombs and weaponry to just wipe each other off the face of the earth. So it had a wonderful message. It was, and I read in your thing that he was, and it's true. He was sort of like a Jesus kind of dude because he came in peace. He gets killed and then he's risen up and he, you know, he just warns everybody, you know, hey, you're going to keep this up. You're going to be incinerated. You're not going to be anymore. And it's a wonderful,
yeah,
wonderful
he turns
film.
Out to be kind of a badass in the end and a little bit intimidating, but his message is necessary. But I always think when I see the end of that movie that, wow, Klaatu is going to be coming back and he's not going to be so nice next time because we just can't stop killing each other.
Which is a horror in its own way.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it is not sci-fi. It is reality. So a lot of these sci-fis where people think it's way out, they're really talking about reality, about things that certainly could happen.
Yeah, and exactly. It's very much a metaphor, you know, for things that are happening on our planet is how I read it. That's why it always strikes me.
Me too. And so 1954's It Came From Outer Space. I like this movie a lot as well. They are.
It's another thought-provoking one about humanity,
right? And they're not. They crash, but they don't mean to crash their flying saucer. They just do, and they don't mean the Earth harm, but they end up, you know, taking over bodies for a while, and they need to get.
Renting them,
right?
Just
to, you know, a day or two here and there because they want to get their spaceship built so they can get out of Dodge. They don't want to be there. And so Richard Carlson is our hero, and the lovely Barbara Rush, who was nominated for a Golden Globe.
Yes, actually, no, she earned a Golden Globe for the most promising female newcomer for that role. Yeah.
Do you know who Richard Carlson always reminds me of, and it makes me feel sad? Do you know who Phil Hartman was? He was on Saturday Night Live.
I loved Phil Hartman on Saturday Night Live.
Yes, and his,
there is a resemblance, you're right.
There's just something about him, and when I see him, it's sort of like, I like to see Richard Carlson, and then part of me goes, because, you know, of poor Phil's demise. But it's a very good movie. Also, it's one that I noticed the professor from Gilligan's Island was kind of cute there. No, you know, he did a bunch of them, you know, especially the crab one.
And then he was also in The Space Children.
He was cute. Marianne
said. He was cute.
He was a cutie, but you know, as a professor, when you're a kid watching these shows, or even now, I mean, he was like a doof. So it's like you can't think that this doof nerd was cute, but...
Well, I did think he was the cutest one on the island because, I mean, look at who his competition is.
Right, he was
Gilligan,
the cutest.
The skipper and Mr. Howell, so pretty much you're going for the professor.
Right, Mr. Howell was with Lovey, and that would never...
Yeah.
That was a love affair to remember, and I can't get it. They try to hook up Gilligan, the professor, with Marianne. And Marianne, Dawn Wells said that had Russell not been married, she would have hopped on him in 1 second because she said he was such a great friend and he was just a real cutie pie deluxe. But
well, that's good to know. Good to know.
It's funny, though. You know, I don't know how I missed it. They did not want to show the monster in this film. But they did, and you have it in your book, and I do not remember that at all, and it is, like, really gross monster.
Yeah.
Like you said, a fried egg with an eye in it.
They don't show him for that long. I think that there were a lot of people, as I say, Ray Bradbury, whose story it was based upon, among them, who begged them not to show the monster at all, but I think they eventually decided to compromise and show it just for a minute.
Yeah, so I must have missed it. Maybe I was like, I don't know.
You were painting your toenails at that moment.
I think I was doing my fingernails, actually.
And
blowing on them so that they would hurry up and dry. Okay, number 7, and I love this movie, Them. 1954, Atomic Age, Deluxe, Mutants.
That was one of the highest grossing movies of the year. It was a really big success, the first giant insect movie.
Is it? Really? Wow, I didn't know that.
Oh, yes. The
giant
first one.
Ants. They were pretty creepy.
Giant ants. They were, they said that in real life, they were actually really creepy. They had originally designed them for a Technicolor movie, and then they scrapped the plans for Technicolor and went with cheaper black and white, but they said that they were purple and slimy and
yeah, they put pretty. Vaseline on it or something.
Right. Uh-huh.
You know what shocked me, though, when I saw that? Because I so know Mr. Gwynn as Santa Claus. So when I mm-hmm. saw him in this role or even any other role, it took me a while to get past him being Kris Kringle.
Doesn't it? It's hard to shake the Kris Kringle. And then if you're a kid and you see them, you're like, oh my God, Santa's being attacked by giant ants. No.
And he has a daughter who's smart and attractive. She's just not the eye candy. She's part of it. She's part of the whole thing.
She is great. I really like her, Pat Medford, the myrmecologist, because yes. as I wrote in the book, she represents one step forward for women in monster movies because, you know, after being lectured by our friend James Arness and some other men about, little lady, you need to leave the dangerous stuff to the men, she insists on going, she gives them a tongue lashing and insists on going right into danger alongside the men. So good for her.
Yes, and I like that. And, you know, we're not just saying, it's not like us saying girl power, but it is nice to see women because women have always contributed to society. Women are not always just standing back because I love this one. When they get afraid or something and they don't do anything, they put their fist in their mouth and kind of look, ah, kind of.
I know.
So it's fun to see someone actually being a participant, being a female, and doing her job, because that's her job. She is doing it.
Right.
And she's
that's
also a hot babe. She's also a hot babe. Okay, good. Good for her.
Yeah, good. I like it too. I like that movie and the character.
Me too. So number 8, this is another one of my faves, Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Oh, yes. Again, we have the same taste in movies because I would call Invasion of the Body Snatchers one of my all-time favorite movies, not just sci-fi or horror.
I'm with you. I'm with you on that.
It's a great movie, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, it's a masterpiece of economy, $350,000 in 19 days. Can you believe it? It was shot.
And yeah. What an incredible film. I mean, I can't even get into it. It's so smart. It's so good. Mm-hmm. And they picked great actors. Kevin McCarthy was mostly known from the stage, and he did a wonderful job. Dana Winter?
Dana Winter, yeah.
She played his ex-love.
I thought they were both great, too. Not big budget, you know, big stars, but did a really good job. And, you know, the premise of it is just so creepy, and it never stops being creepy.
No.
It's almost creepier today in an era when I feel like, you know, everyone is sort of walking around looking at their cell phones, and everyone's on medication for antidepressants, and maybe not everyone, but it's common. You almost feel like we are losing our humanity, you
well,
know, that's
how
I feel.
In many ways,
anyway.
We are. I agree. And it's like, you know, you're in, I go to nice restaurants, evening, candles, whatever, and I see people with their phones pulled out. They're not talking to each other. They're looking at their phones. And it's,
isn't that horrible?
Or they're taking 7 zillion selfies. Here I am.
I know, right? And you're not really there
no.
if you're doing that.
No,
you're not
you're
participating
not.
In the moment. It's a little eerie to me.
So
I get flashes of Invasion of the Body Snatchers when people do things
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, and I agree with you because I'm totally down with you on that because it's all really freaky. Also, I loved the co-stars, and the ending was fabulous, which we won't get to. They did a remake. When was that?
70? I like the remake as well, too. Yeah,
I
that's
do
a really
too.
Good remake.
It is mm-hmm. one of the better remakes, although I like the first one the best. And the remake
yeah.
stars Donald Sutherland, Brooke Adams, Veronica Cartwright? That one?
Yes, Veronica Cartwright and Jeff Goldblum.
Who I love those two. And I love Veronica. Mm-hmm. They were all great. And it was a really good one. And I you know, it's not often you can recommend a sequel, but that was a really good one as well. But
agreed.
Numero uno, The Invasion of the Body Snatchers, 1956, is definitely the best. And underneath that one, this is one movie I really love. I Married a Monster from Outer Space. It's not in the book, but
yeah, I like that one too. It's kind of fun. I hadn't seen it until I was researching this book, and I was like, oh, this is an interesting hybrid of a kind of a woman's melodrama and a sci-fi, isn't it?
It is. And she's like angsty. Why is my husband not wanting me? And these guys take over and possess the bodies of these men. Because all the women on their planet are dead. So they want to reproduce, you know, I guess, alien chick kind of thing, and have babies with these ugly women, which when you see them, they're like, eek. But I love it. Gloria Talbot's fabulous. Tom, how do you pronounce this? Tryon. He was great.
Oh,
as
I'll
the
have
monster.
To look that up. Yeah, I don't even remember. It's been a while since I've seen that one. I need to check it out again, but I really enjoyed it.
Me too.
Yeah.
I liked it a lot. It wasn't cheesy. It was very, it's like, what happened to my husband? This is not the guy I married. And that's like life a lot of times.
It is. It's just like Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I think that's why those are so powerful today. They really hold up because, you know, a lot of the other movies may be good, but I think some of the monsters don't age as well when you have a styrofoam kind of cheesy monster with a big eyeball like the fried egg we talked about.
that doesn't
age as well. But in Invasion, you know, it's people. It's people that have been changed inside. And that's really ageless and creepy.
Very. Okay, so we're going to hit this one, The Blob, 1958. Love this movie.
Love it.
Me too. One thing I laugh about is Steve McQueen was 27 when this was made, and he was like the oldest looking teenager ever. He was good in it. I liked him, but I'm so like, because he had a hard life. So Steve had those deep forehead wrinkles and things like that. He really did have a hard life if you read about him. And his childhood
horrible. He didn't look like a smooth high school kid.
No, Richie Cunningham from Happy Days. He was not that. But he was very good. And he was on a date with Anita Corso, who you may remember, you guys, she was on, I think it's still on TV Land all the time, the Andy Griffith Show. It was Andy's babe, Helen Crump. What a name. Yeah.
Right. We have more Andy Griffith crossover, right? Because it was also in Aunt B was in Day the Earth Stood Still.
Yes. Aunt B was there. And I loved it. And they save the day. It's the teenagers. They're not like rebel without a cause. They are like teenagers with a cause. We're going to get that blob. Mm-hmm. And they did. But I love the movie theater scene. I adore that. That's one of my favorite scenes in the movie. And what I
loved. Oh, when I was a kid, I couldn't wait for that. That was the whole movie to me. It was when the blob comes through the movie theater.
That was so much fun.
A climax.
It is. And what makes me laugh so hard is that I read they have Blobathon. Is it a Blobathon? Mm-hmm. And they recreate that scene
in Phoenixville, Pennsylvania. That's where they shot the movie. Yes. I have to go to that one.
I would love to go to that. I'm at East Coast. If you go, I'll meet you. We should go to that Blobathon. That would be a blast.
It's a date. Let's plan it.
Okay. Here we come, Blobs. And he didn't really like it, but you wrote that at the time of his death, did he have like a poster of that on his wall?
It's Steve McQueen, when he died, and he had a horrible death too, poor thing, in Mexico trying to cure his cancer.
The whole nine yards, yeah.
Yeah, so, but at the time of his death, he did have a poster of the blob on his wall. I think he finally came to accept and appreciate it.
Or maybe he saw it as
a metaphor for death.
Of his, the cancer, the blob taking over his body. I'm getting deep here.
I thought about that too. Snap, 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 something to think about.
Yes, but who knows? Yeah. He just could have just said, hey, I want the blob picture up there. This is just, you know, that. Okay, the next one we're going to is a time machine.
That one's a fun one.
Very fun. Starring that adorable devil from Australia. This was his first starring role, right? Rod Taylor.
It was his first big starring role, yes. He had done some other movies, but he was sort of debuting here in color as a leading man. I thought he did a great job.
He was great. They had a lot of great supporting actors. Alan Young, I loved as his Scottish friend. And the time machine actually worked, and he got into this land of blonde people. Where they came from with these beautiful flowers and beautiful fruits. But there was only one problem, the Morlocks.
Well, also the other problem is that the blondes are not a highly intelligent race. I think there's something lacking there in the brain department.
Yeah, somebody goes out and almost drowns, so he has to go save. And he said, what is wrong with you people?
Yeah.
They didn't know how to fight. They didn't know how to do anything. They just, you know, went to where they go. And then when he finally got in there, he saw not only were the Morlocks creepy-looking dudes and short, but they were cannibals. And you see all these bones, you know, that they ate all these blonde people.
Yeah, and, more social commentary, I think.
Yeah.
We'll have to analyze that
one. And why in the world? And nobody got old. They were all like young blondes. So how did new blondes come up? I never got that one. And
I have questions about that as well. And I guess we'll have to read the original novel to get
more
detail.
I don't get it. And the Morlocks, I have to say, remind me of the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, the Abominable Snowman. They kind of remind me of
him. Oh, yeah, they do. And their eyes flash.
Yes. So it was very good, and he decides, well, we're not going to tell you the end, but he meets this lady. What's her name?
Weena.
Weena, who is Yvette Mimieux, quite the babe. And
yes,
he falls for her, as does Weena fall for him, but he gets out of Dodge, and he lands back in his garage in the winter. And it's so funny, like he's only been gone for a minute or two or whatever, and he's taken this huge trip, which I guess this is really there have been a lot of time travel, but this was like the real.
This was the first time travel movie, though. It was
it
the
was?
First time machine on film, I believe. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Next one I want to go to, and I love this film. Planet of the Apes, 1968.
Yeah, Planet of the Apes is another seminal movie. I mean, not even taking into account the more recent reboots and all the sequels. Just the first movie to me is amazing and groundbreaking. It has so many different layers to it. You know, the first half hour is really just sci-fi. It's like we're in a spaceship and it crashes, you know, on a planet. Then the apes come in, and the social commentary, the suspense, there's some dark comedy in it too, don't you find?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I love when he kisses Kim Hunter, and she says, okay, but you're so damn ugly. And that's how
I know.
You know, like when spiders look at us, and I'm going like, because I'm like a spider, I go, ah, in my head. And I'm just thinking, the spider's got eight eyes, and he's looking at me and going, ah. Monster, ugly, ooh. So it's just
right.
That.
It's all in the perspective.
But it's funny because there is a hierarchy there. You know, it just never changes no matter who's there. Of course, humans are on the bottom of the food chain, but orangutans, numero uno, chimps, number two, and gorillas, numero three.
Right. Yeah. It's very pointed social satire. And also the whole thing about, you know, denying evolution in their case, you know, the opposite of what we're doing. It's,
right.
It's kind of thought-provoking there.
Very. You know, and I waited so long to watch it because it's just like, oh, Planet of the Apes. You know, I'm not a big Charlton Heston fan. And I don't know when I finally watched it, maybe 1992 or something. And I loved it. And I love that the amazing, I think he's so prophetic in so many ways. Rod Serling, he came up, and we're not going to tell you about the twist ending, but he brought that about. And that ending is like, wow, that hits you right. I didn't see it coming. Pow, wow, zow. That was amazing.
Yeah, it is amazing. It's a great, and it's kind of amazing that the original author, Pierre Boulle, didn't think of that and that no one thought of that until Rod Serling came along, isn't it? That's like the perfect ending. It
was
makes so much
sense.
The best
ending, and it was so wonderful. Okay, so why don't we do one more? There are so many. She has 50, and there are so many more I could talk about, but I just wanted to hit on some basics. Logan's Run. I like to laugh. I laughed.
I'm glad you picked Logan's Run because I have a lot to say about Logan's Run.
I know,
and
I
usually want to talk about that one.
Off. I love it. I love it.
Well, you know, Logan's Run really fascinates me because it's not the greatest sci-fi movie ever made, perhaps, but it's so interesting that it came out 6 months before Star Wars. And Star Wars is, of course, the one that everyone remembers today, but Logan's Run, ironically, is more prescient and more predictive, I think, of the future in so many ways.
Yes, I agree.
It has a lot to say about our society that I think we would do well to heed. I mean, look at it's the only movie I've seen, and I haven't seen every science fiction movie ever made from every country in the world, but it's the only one I've ever seen that really predicts smartphones. I mean, they have these devices in Logan's Run. I don't know what they're called, but they look like smartphones. They're these black square boxes. They take pictures on them. They can send the pictures to the computer. They talk to each other on them like walkie-talkies. Very, very eerily similar to the devices that we have today, plus their computer dating circuit and all of this stuff that they have, that they were sort of dazzled by this technology to the point where they were ignoring the real problems that were going on in their society.
That nobody could live to be 30, which is also the youth thing. Like somebody said, never trust anybody over 30 if you're 30. So Logan was a sandman, and they catch runners who don't want to be part of the carousel where you're reborn. Hence, guess what? You're not really. But I'm not going to spoil it that much if you've never seen the movie. I love the thing, like, you know, and it's like Tinder, swipe, but you're there immediately, you know?
It's like, yeah, it's like a real live swipe, and you're the person you pick is right there in your bedroom.
And I love how it goes like this, that first he gets a guy, Michael York, and he smiles and says no. Then he finds Jenny Agutter, and he likes her, but she's not in, you know, she doesn't want to have, let's have sex, you know, come on over. And he said, oh, do you like women? You know, which is so funny. Oh, I'm not wanting to have sex with you right now. And oh, if you don't want to have sex with me right now, that must mean you're a lesbian.
Right, I know.
That, you know, I have a headache, man. I'm really, I don't know, you know, I'm not really into it tonight, you know? So that cracks me up. And another thing that cracked me up that you wrote, I guess it was from Time Magazine, that said that their togas were from like Fredericks of Hollywood.
Yeah. Well, Time Magazine called their costumes togas designed by Fredericks of Hollywood, which is so perfect, isn't it?
Yeah. And it was like a disco joint. Farrah Fawcett was in it briefly.
Very 70s. It's like the most 70s movie that's set in the future,
right?
You know, that I've ever seen. Very typical 70s. You have the blue eyeshadow, you have jacuzzis, you have all these laser lights and disco and leather couches. It's 70s to the extreme.
Very disco inferno. And just, I liked it. I mean, but it has a lot to say. you know, about ageism, about all, you know, and maybe I'm looking deeply into things. And believe me, I'd watch a movie and I just enjoy it. But then I can think about it and go, I love this, what this is saying and what this is saying. And maybe it's not saying anything that I think it's saying. But I do go in enjoying the movie. I'm not sitting there writing notes to criticize. I go and watch. And then later I might write a note to criticize or to just make one of my thoughts of what I think the movie's about. But that was
The original story was, you know, the author who wrote the original story, I believe, did say that it was about the lack of respect for old people in our society. So talk about, you know, something we're dealing with today.
Which is horrible. And I love Soylent Green, too. Because you know why I love Soylent Green? Just because of Edward G. Robinson's performance. I thought he was amazing in that. The whole thing about that.
Charlton Heston was good too. I mean, you got to give him that. You got to give Heston his due for Planet of the Apes and Soylent Green.
I do. And he had quite the bod, man. I mean, hubba hubba Charlton, or Chuck, as your friends call you.
Chuck. And he was practically naked for most of Planet of the Apes.
Great butt, man. Good movies. Anyway, I have had such a great time talking to you, Sloan. I have enjoyed this tremendously. It's been a lot of fun.
And I've enjoyed it too, Grace. I'm so glad that you asked me to be on your show.
And I'm thrilled you're coming on. I also would love you to come on to talk about your other book about dames. 50 Dames.
Dynamic Dames.
Dynamic Dames. So I hope you will come on to do that one because I love that book as well. I have it. So,
thank you. I would love to.
I had a great time. And remember, if you want to go to the Blobathon, I'm not far, so I'll go with you. I'm in.
That sounds great. Let's plan it. Instead of Comic-Con, we'll go to the Blobathon.
That sounds fun. And I'll dress as Anita Corso. How's that?
I'll get a big red gushy costume.
Oh yeah,
and I'll be the Blob.
Great. So you can see. I'm going to link her up anyway, but you can find Sloan's stuff at sloanforDeForest.com, and you can find her books. 50 Dynamic Dames. It's also TCM, but you can get it on Amazon or anywhere else. And you can find it through her website. And also this wonderful book, Must See Sci-Fi, 50 Movies That Are Out of This World, TCM.
Yes, both TCM books.
Yes. And I do hope you come on again and do the dames because I had such a great time talking to you.
I enjoyed it too. We'll have to talk about dames next time.
Dames, and more dames.
All right.
Okay, everybody. So thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back next week. And thanks so much to Sloan. And you'll be hearing from her again, talking dames. All right, everybody. Thank you. Thanks, Sloan. Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
With his pants falling down, or the dance that's a dream of romance, or the scene where the villain is mean, that's entertainment. The lights on the lady in tights, or the bride with the guy on the side, or the ball where she gives him her all, that's entertainment. A fight like you see on the screen, a swain getting slain for the love of a queen, some great Shakespearean scene where a ghost and a prince meet and everyone ends in mincemeat. The gag may be waving the flag that began with the Mr. Cohan, hip hooray, the American way. The stage is a world of